This is tape number 15, Plenary Session, a three-decade retrospective of the Masters and Johnson Institute with William H. Masters, recorded live at the 26th Annual Meeting of the Society for the Scientific Study of Sex, November 18th through 20th, 1983, at the McCormick Inn.
My name is Vern Bullo, and I'm president of the Society for the Scientific Study of Sex. And with this meeting, sexology returns to its Midwestern roots, since both the Kinsey team and the Masters and Johnson team worked and practiced in the Midwest. I think it's worth having, this is particularly important since this is the first meeting of a national sex group in the Midwest in my memory. And I think with the return to the Midwest of this organization, it's only fitting we have before us one of the great pioneers of modern sexology. I think every one of us would put Bill and Virginia in the company of the Kinsey team in terms of importance of modern sex research. From the historical viewpoint, which I always like to bring in, Master's great contribution was to reemphasize the importance of physiology in understanding the human sexual response. Though Kinsey was a biologist, and other sex researchers have come from varying backgrounds, the dominant theme in the last 30 or 40 years in writing about sex has been psychological. The result, in my opinion, was a distortion of the problems associated with human sexuality, since sex is not only psychological, it's biological, it's sociological, it's cultural, and many of these fields are spanned by modern medicine. It is largely due to Masters and Johnson that today's practitioners and researchers recognize the critical importance of the biological. Another historical insight into Bill Masters is found when one tries to trace influences, something that has not been done so much in sex research. Bill studied under George W. Korner, and so did Mary Calderon. It was George W. Korner who was on the Rockefeller team, which gave Alfred Kinsey his original grant, and who was his major supporter within the Rockefeller Foundation. Korner himself was deeply influenced by Robert Latou Dickinson, who in American medical history is probably the most influential of the physicians working to study human sexuality at the turn of the century. And so we have a kind of continuous, ongoing tradition in American sex research. It was also George Korner who gave Masters a well-known advice summarized by Ed Brecker when Masters asked him about sex research. He said, the sex researcher should wait till he was at least 40 before tackling sex research. He should earn a scientific reputation in some other scientific field, and he should wait until he could secure the sponsorship of a major medical school or university. Bill did not quite follow this. Technically, he began doing his research into sexual response at 38, but in another sense, he's always been in sex research since most of his early research was on hormones. The important thing about Bill, though, above all, is he has been a professional. He is not a missionary for sex, not even a conscious popularizer. Rather, he is a researcher first and foremost. He has also been a team player. And in honoring him, we also honor Virginia Johnson, who joined this team in the late 50s and who is continuing to work in the field. All of us owe Bill Masters a debt of gratitude. We would not be here today without their findings. The task we now have is to build upon them, modify them where necessary, but continue to recognize what Bill did. I consider it a great honor to introduce Bill Masters.
Thank you. You know, I had a cold chill yesterday flying up from St. Louis. I always get a cold chill when I fly into O'Hare anyway. But I had another cold chill because it suddenly occurred to me, and it is fascinating how time does. It suddenly occurred to me that anybody much under 45 in the room wouldn't know what I was talking about for the first part of my session. Had no frame of reference as to the times. Except as you heard Vern yesterday talking about the background of his own difficulties. Matter of fact, I can even say much under 50. because next year is a anniversary year for us in many ways. As of July 1st in 54, we will have been 30 years since we got permission to work at Washington University. As of January 1st in 54, it will have been 25 years since we started the clinical research program, and 20 years since we started the institute. So many anniversaries next year for us, 20 to 30. How did we get started? Well, Vern told you, put the foot in the door. As a youngster in medical school, I had a year out between my first and second years to work to do research with a man named George Korner, who was one of the original reproductive biologists of this country, who is better known to the medical fraternity as the man who identified progesterone. I spent a year in Korner's laboratory trying to prove that rabbits menstruated. I was spectacularly unsuccessful. They just wouldn't do it for me. But I learned a lot. And what really happened after that was I went back and joined the medical school class as a sophomore. And after I had finished trying to prove rabbits menstruated, George Korner gave up and left University of Rochester and moved to the Carnegie Institute of Embryology in Baltimore to head it. And there gathered around him the reproductive biologists of the country. It was an incredible concentration of talent, the younger Flexner, Carl Hartman, that group. My junior year in medical school, shortly after Christmas, I got this wonderful letter from George Korner saying that if I didn't have other plans, he would be delighted to have me join the group during my spring vacation of my junior year in medical school. Well, needless to say, I arrived, and a young man sitting at the end of the table listening to the Giants talk was an awe-inspiring experience. One day, a couple of days before I was due to leave, Carl Hartman came in. This was one of the original monkey colonies in the country, and he was all scratched up. This monkey bitch in heat would not mate for him, and he was screaming about the fact we don't know really anything about the female monkeys and their sex interest, despite their show of interest on the reddening of the bottom. And so I asked the question, what do we know about human female? And how could one go about finding out what we don't know? And for the last two or three sessions here in this group, the powers that be chatted and discussed and developed a set of criteria that Vern just discussed for you. There were four criteria. The first one was obvious. It had to be a male, but you must remember this was 1941. Number two, the individual had to have a certain amount of chronological seniority. Well, I've been bald since 23, so that helped. And number three, he had to have a definitive research reputation in an extraneous field. And finally, four, he had to have university, certainly, and preferably medical school support. Well, it wasn't long after that that Kinsey and Korner got together in terms of support, trying to raise money for the institute. And obviously, Alfred Kinsey met all these criteria. It's an interesting background, and I never had, as Wardell knows, I never had the privilege of knowing Kinsey. Shook his hand on the reception line once. It's the only time I ever met the man. But this is how the entanglement began. I do want to talk a little bit about Kinsey Institute and its our debt to it. And I'm talking really about Kinsey and Wardell and Martin and Gebhardt. Without their near original foot in the doorway, we would have never been allowed to work. There's no question about that whatsoever. These people broke the ice. When I went to the powers that be at Washington University in 1953, the two male and female books, and male book was out, the male female book was just being published, I asked for permission to work in human sexuality. Well, obviously there was a precedent set. A man by the name, I think, Wardell Wells, wasn't that his name, president of Indiana, had been the man with the courage to allow these researchers the opportunity to ply their trade. So Washington University had a precedent. They were terrified, that's a kind way of saying it. But had they known what we were going to do, they'd have been even more so. They thought we were they thought it was going to be more of the same, and we weren't about to play in the Kinsey League. We were completely outbatted, and that wasn't our frame of reference. We were more interested in the basic physiology and the basic psychology of sexual functioning. Well, we got permission to work in a very backhanded way. As I say, it was in the 53 that I went to the... Well, first I went to my professor, and he said, "Bill, I think you better talk to the dean." And I was with the dean for a minute or two, and he said, "Bill, I think you better talk to the chancellor." So I went to talk to the chancellor, a man by the name of Shepley, who was every bit as much Wells as Wells was. And he said, "Well, I don't know that I can get permission or not, but I have to talk to the Board of Trustees." And I heard no more from him. This was in the fall of 53. And then in June, late June, middle June of 54, I got this gives you some idea of the man, I got this little note, handwritten note in my mailbox, saying that in my busy schedule, if I could find time, the Chancellor would like to talk to me. Well, most assistant professors can find time to talk to the Chancellor. So I worked it into my busy schedule and approached the Chancellor. He said, "Bill, I hooked him on the basis of academic freedom, and as of July 1st, you can start. What are you going to do?" I said, "Well, sir, I have the vaguest idea. I never thought I'd get permission to work. But after I've decided what I want to do, I'll come back and talk." Wonderful. Well, 4th of July was upon us, so actually on the 5th of July in 54, I did it what all good little researchers do. I went to the library to find out what had been written on the subject of human physiology, and excited from having read the new Kinsey text on the female part, the physiology chapters in that. There was one other book, and this was Atlas of Human Sexual Anatomy by the author that Byrne just discussed. Interestingly enough, this man also was an OBGYN man who waited to publish his Atlas of Human Sexual Anatomy until after he had retired. Again, sign of the times. Well, this atlas was on the reserve shelf in the medical school library, and as of July 1st, I had been promoted. I was now modestly an associate professor. And so when I went up to the young lady at the desk to ask for the book on the reserve shelf, she said, "Well, Dr. Masters, aren't you an associate professor?" Well, I thought she was going to congratulate me. I said, "Yes." She said, "I'm sorry, sir, you can't have the book." This is true. This is 1954, July 1954. I said, "I don't want the book, I just want to look at it." "I'm sorry, sir, it's on the reserve shelf." "I know that, that's why I'm here." "No, I don't believe you understand. The reserve shelf is reserved for full professors and heads of departments." So literally, this is true, this is a medical school that just gave permission to a sex research. I had to walk across the street to my OBGYN department, get my professor, and said, "Look, I've got troubles already. I can't look at the book." Well, he said, "I'll write you a letter saying you're in good standing." Which he did, and I took it back across the street, and I couldn't have the book. This man had to get out of his chair, walk across the street, take it out in his name, and hand it to me. This is true. When I returned the book, about a week later, same lady was there, and she looked at me apprehensively, and I said, "Is it really true that this book is on reserve shelf for just full professors and heads of departments?" She said, "Oh, yes, Dr. Masson." She reached down in the desk, and she had this proceedings of the executive faculty. For some reason, there was a white paper right at the point where this was done in the year before. In the year before, the library committee of the executive faculty had ruled that all books on the reserve shelf were hereafter reserved only to the use of full professors, heads of departments, and librarians. But anyway, having thought about it for a while, I went back to the chancellor. And I said, I need a sabbatical. He looked at me a little askance. He said, well, that was an exhausting research study, wasn't it? And I said, no, I really need freedom to move around. He said, well, what are you going to do? I said, well, I've looked for all the experts. I can't find any, so I better go to those that know something about it. And so I said, I want to go live with the prostitute population for about a year. The man turned deathly pale. He said, well, I'll tell you, politically it would be poor to give you a sabbatical you haven't earned. And besides, the university needs the income from your practice. But how can we work this out so that you can have some time? I said, well, the best way that I can think of to work it out is that we need a review board. He said, well, what is your status? I said, well, I head the Division of Reproductive Biology, as you know, in the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology. He said, you want a board for the division within the department within the medical school and the university? I said, yes, sir. He said, well, I've never been asked that before. He said, well, who's going to head the board? Well, I said, I thought you might. Who else do you want on the board? Well, we want there are two daily papers in St. Louis, one of these two men, the publishers. I want the chief of police, and I want religious representation. And so we did. And you might be interested to know how we got to work with the prostitute population throughout the middle part of the United States, a little bit on the West Coast, not much, a little in Canada, a little in Mexico. Through the police chiefs, one to another, any time that I was in the neighborhood, there was a gentleman's agreement that the police would not raise. You see, this was right at the time of both house and call, transition time. And the agreement was that they wouldn't raid the houses for a week before I got there, the week I was there, and the week after I left. So I was very popular. And I learned a lot from these people. Once I realized I wasn't just somebody who wanted to interview them a time or two and write a term paper, they opened up. And they taught me one of the most important things about in interviewing in terms of developing a sexual history. People inevitably tell you first what they want you to know. Then the second time through, they might tell you what they think you want to know, and it's rarely before the third or fourth time through on an intensely personal subject that they tell you like it is with them. We always use that as a form of input in our taking sex histories. You know, it's a little word to the wise that some of you may find important. They also taught us a lot about sexual functioning, sexual stimulation techniques. We worked with both male and female prostitutes, of course. Anyway, that was the background. And during this time, it was a year and a half, I was trying to work out some techniques whereby one could record physiology of sexual response with the incredibly poor instrumentation that we had available at the time. But the most important thing that ever happened, in not only in my life, but in terms of the research productivity, developed in March of 56, when I was at the Chase Hotel. Some of you know the Park Plaza Chase Hotel in St. Louis. Up in one of the rooms on a Saturday afternoon with a most attractive woman, prostitute who had a PhD in sociology and had hit upon a uniquely tax-free method of enhancing her university salary. She was really quite verbal, and she was trying desperately to get across this thought or this part of the subjective aspects of female sexual response. And I had no frame of reference of what she was talking about. I simply couldn't appreciate her. Finally, another exacerbation. She said, you know, Dr. Masters, you're never really going to know anything about the subjective aspects of female sexual functioning, are you? What a thing to tell an OBGYN man that knows everything about the female. But of course, she's right. She was right. She said, what she needs is an interpreter. And I thought about that over the weekend, and the more I thought about it, the more I realized how right she was. I'd love to take credit for developing the concept of doing research with the dual sex team, or even therapy with the dual sex team, but it isn't my credit. It belongs to this sociologist. She said, what you need is an interpreter, so I began hunting for an interpreter. And in a completely chauvinistic way, and oh my, was it chauvinistic, I'll give you the criteria to give you some idea of what I'm talking about. I went to the university employment office, rather I called them, I didn't go out, and asked them, told them I had some criteria for someone to come work, and oh yes sir, and I put it down, and after they got all through, there was this dead silence on the end of the telephone. And the story was, you don't really expect us to find anyone who will meet these criteria, do you? I said, yes, I do, of course. Isn't that your job? Well, as a matter of fact, they sent a number of people over a period of time, and finally it wasn't until December of 56 that I ran into Ginny, and she met the following criteria. I'll read them. A, good with people, because I'm not. That was the first step. B, have to work. C, married and divorced and at least one child. This is not chauvinistic, of course. E, intelligent. And F, no postgraduate degree. Everything is self-explanatory except the no postgraduate degree. Again, remember this was 1956. I could not bear the responsibility of having someone lose, in this case, a hard-fought PhD or MS. They were infinitely rare for the females in the mid-50s. I couldn't bear to have that happen as a result of working with this research program. And I was well aware I had a good chance of losing an MD, but I couldn't bear the other responsibility. So it was with a malice aforethought that Ginny did not have a postgraduate degree at the time. It gives you some idea of the sign of the times, and this was before we got started. Well, we spent 1958, we began working in the physiology laboratory in 1957, she joined me January 2nd, 57. I want to talk briefly about that. We've always had two types of population, those who work with us in the research laboratory and those that we see in clinical practice. Those who work in research laboratory are, at least historically, as we see them before they start working with us, perfectly capable of full sexual response to manipulative stimuli or coital stimuli if they're heterosexual. And otherwise, we wouldn't have them in the laboratory. We have never, despite many rumors to the contrary, we have never had a dysfunctional man or woman in the research laboratory, in the physiology laboratory. Can't imagine putting that type of pressure on them. So it's simply to set the record straight. The thing that amazed me was how easy it was to find study subjects. We started working with the female physiology first because we knew that would be much more difficult than the male. How wrong we were. The male is infinitely more difficult to work with in the laboratory than the female. But mid-50s, no idea. Anyway, we started working with the female, and our difficulty was, as we started, and how did we get volunteers? Well, we began asking people. That was the first concept of volunteer, and it wasn't long before people were talking to people and volunteering. Our big thing was that we could promise them anonymity. Therefore, we had to work unusual times and unusual hours. This is what began the seven-day week. We began working 7 days a week, with the exception of Sunday afternoons, and three nights a week. We worked Monday and Wednesday, or Tuesday and Thursday, and then we worked Friday night all night long. It was much easier to protect people in the midst of a busy medical school center. While during 1956, while I was hunting for the interpreter, the medical school built us our little research lab. It reminded me a great deal of a compartment in a Pullman train. It was about as commodious. It was a little, quote, sitting room, unquote, where we took histories and talked to people. There was a bedroom, And there were two Johns. One of the Johns also had egress to the outside because it was a Carter John, and we had the, you know, jointly locked doors. We left that to the mail. To give you some idea of the sign of the times, we finally had to take ceiling sound protection and paste it over the side walls of the John because the docs would get in there with stethoscopes to listen through the wall to see what we were doing. We had to work nights, weekends, and holidays because the university personnel would gather in the corridors to have lunch where we had egress from the stairs to the rooms. They'd sit on the stairs to have lunch. Never saw them on the stairs before or after in my life, but there they would stand to have lunch and see if they could catch who was coming in to see them, to work with us. It was fascinating to watch. Anyway, we worked out in the course of 58, we began theorizing at clinical application of the physiology we were learning. If ever we became convinced that what we're doing now in this discipline is obvious, in this specialty, is that it is obviously a multidiscipline specialty, it became obvious as we were working in physiology and trying to develop some sort of psychotherapeutic application. Neither Jenny nor I had any training in psychotherapy. I'd had 3 months in the Department of Psychiatry and Interview Techniques, and that was the sum total of our experience. We had one great advantage. We didn't know what couldn't be done. And that's a tremendous advantage in the mid-50s in terms of psychotherapy. So we theorized the concepts of the rapid treatment of sexual dysfunction. And it is based primarily on our definition of psychotherapy, which is that it is an educational process, effective psychotherapy. So we didn't go to the background of the psychotherapists, we went to the background of the educational people. And that's where the concept of the rapid treatment came from. If you remember, in the 30s, the educationalists were practicing and working with the concept of summer school, rapid educational program. Could people learn in 6 weeks what they'd had a full semester to learn otherwise? And the answer was yes, of course, and with time to spare. So if we were to apply this concept of education, why not apply some of the concepts that education had to as well? And that's where the rapid treatment started. Originally, the concept was for 3 weeks, and we found that was too long. Also, it didn't fit with vacation schedules. So we narrowed it to 2 weeks, and the average stay, the average time in therapy is to about 12 days. Again, it's a 7-day week we're talking about. Well, there were other concepts theorized, and they came as follows. I'd like to review them with you. I suppose the dual-sex team from our laboratory experience. The greatest mistake that could have ever been made was to try to do the basic physiology as a single-sex entity. It would have always been 2-to-1. Just the presence of the opposite sex was reassuring in a laboratory environment. And then we must always remember the dictum of the sociologist. You, Bill Masters, are never really going to appreciate the subjective aspects of female sexual functioning. You need an interpreter. Well, so does therapy. It is so terribly important. Are dual-sex teams always necessary? Of course not. Do they have an advantage? Certainly. If you're dealing with the concept of sexual dysfunction as a relationship problem, which again was a theory that we were trying to support, we never considered impotence as a male problem or anorgasmia as a female problem if there was a relationship. We considered it as a problem of the relationship. And as I will talk and as I have repeatedly talked, I'll talk a little later on, but as I have repeatedly said, the basic principle upon which all the work has been based is that sex is a natural function. Now, many of you have heard me talk about sex as a natural function, and I've gotten literally nowhere in my discussions because none of us ever treat it that way. The culture won't allow it. But it is a natural function, and it's in exactly the same category as respiratory bowel or bladder function. And until we as a discipline can educate the general public to this fact, and let's not start with the general public, let's start, for instance, with the medical profession, we're going to be in difficulties. Because medicine has no frame of reference, neither does the general public. In any event, as I say, we insisted that sexual dysfunction was a relationship problem, and next that the therapist had full, therapist or therapists had full responsibility of delineating between organic and psychogenic etiology for dysfunction. I want to make my point completely clear. As a young man in the OBGYN house staff, and as years later, I've seen many an appendix taken out for psychosocial etiology. Well, can this happen? Of course. If it happens regularly, I have grave concern about the competence of that surgeon. Not to take the appendix out, but to know when to take it out and leave it alone. I feel it is just as inexcusable, just as much malpractice, to do psychotherapy in an overt case of organic dysfunction as it is the other way around. And we as psychotherapists have not assumed that degree of responsibility. If the surgeon takes out too many normal appendices, it isn't long before somebody taps him on the shoulder, and it's a member of the tissue committee, and he says, oh boy, let's have a little chat. Who taps the psychotherapist on the shoulder when he or she has done several cases of organic etiology for a matter of a long period of time? Let me give you an example of what I'm talking about. In dealing with ejaculatory incompetence, we have had six individuals who answered no to the following three questions. One, these are individuals who come in with their wives who have never been able to ejaculate with a penis contained in the vagina. First question, have you ever been able to ejaculate in another vagina? And if the answer is no, you ask the next question. If it's yes, you don't have to bother with the other questions. Next question, have you ever been able to ejaculate with a penis either with manipulation or by manipulation? If the answer is no, you have to ask the last question, which is, have you ever had a wet dream? If it's no to all three things, before you ever do psychotherapy, you must introduce this individual to a competent, and I mean a really competent urologist, and say, I wish to find out whether this man has congenital absence of the ejaculatory ducts. We've had six individuals who said no to all three questions. Three of them had congenital absence of the ejaculatory ducts, and those three people together had a combined total of 23 years of psychotherapy for ejaculatory discomfort. I find that inexcusable. I find that malpractice. All you had to do was ask three questions. This is why it is so terribly important that we realize that no matter what discipline we start with, and it doesn't matter what discipline we start with, behavioral science or biologic science, doesn't matter. The training is not sufficient under the day for this field as one's going to move into the clinical side. One has some postgraduate education to accomplish. The next factor that has been continuously overlooked, and it is so important, was that we insisted on social isolation of the clients. Now this became easy for us. It became patently obvious what we were doing, because after the third year of therapy, it then became true that anywhere from 85 to 95% on any given year, let's say 90% on an average, of all the clients we've seen since 1962 had been from out of the St. Louis area. So we had social isolation at our fingertips. For those in the St. Louis area, that 10% approximately, we insist that from Wednesday to Sunday at each of the 2 weeks that these two people be isolated. If they have kids, the kids are farmed out, or mom and pop farm themselves to a motel, we don't care which, to work on their problem. I've seen a lot of work done describing the relative values of once a day for 2 weeks as opposed to once a week for 14 weeks. But everybody neglects the social isolation. I find it very difficult to conceive a socially isolated couple for 14 weeks, not for 2 weeks. And it's an incredibly important factor, as we pointed out in HSI. If you're going to follow the presumption that you're dealing with a relationship, then as many extraneous factors as you can remove during that two-week period, the better. It is so important, and yet it has been overlooked and neglected so much. and it is not hard to accomplish. Originally, we were told that you could never get a couple to come and work with you in therapy. Well, that concept of bringing the couple went back to 1946 when we first started working in infertility, and we insisted that the husband had something to do with getting the wife pregnant. That's really very serious, because everyone knew that the man ejaculated, that was all that was necessary in the mid-40s. And the story was, you can't get men to come in. Well, we made it very easy. We wouldn't take the wife if the husband wouldn't come. And now all over the world, if there's an infertility problem, they expect the husband and wife to come in. The same thing will be true here in another 10 years if we stick to our guns. But it takes some time. And finally, we simply decided that two things. One, that obviously the follow-up was as important as acute phase of therapy, just as important. We had 13 years of five-year follow-up before we decided that this was too much. Better than 90% of everything goes wrong the first 2 years, so now we have about 8 years of two-year follow-up. And we decided to tape all sessions. This came from being on the board of a social agency and realizing that they spent 20% of their time writing and keeping records. Incredible waste of professional time. So all records are taped, and the tape becomes a part of the medical legal review, and it has another distinct advantage, and that is if one wishes to listen to it, one can review a session with the greatest of ease. If there's been an effective session, one doesn't have to sit down with the patients again. One can bring the patients in and listen to the session. It's also tremendously important. You might be interested. We have a judicial precedent that if, for instance, a couple leaves and they divorce, and the wife, say, wishes part of the record to prove that her husband's background was quality sufficient for the divorce, it would be on the tape. We don't have to release the tape unless the husband signs permission as well. Because it's both of them. If you have individual records, they're subpoenaable. The tape is not subpoenaable unless you have both people, and it's a matter of tremendous protection. You might think about that. Okay. So with that theory behind us in 58, we moved to the onset of the therapy program in January of 59. The first 5 years, everybody was told that we were totally inexperienced, that this was an experimental program, and there would be no charge. We felt it totally unfair to charge for therapy if we didn't know what we were doing, and boy, we didn't know what we were doing. After 64, we began charging, and the charges have obviously varied in terms of the times to date. In 60-61, we had the privilege of starting one of the early required courses for human sexuality for the medical students. It's fascinating. The first course we hid ourselves in an eight hours of lecture in reproductive biology. The first hour was devoted to female infertility, and that was totally acceptable. Then we devoted an hour to male infertility. That wasn't so acceptable. And finally, the next hour was female sexual physiology. After the lecture, a number of the medical students objected. They formed a committee. They represented about 20 to 25% of the class, waited on the dean, demand that lectures be discontinued. Three members of the executive faculty went to the dean and demanded that the lectures be discontinued. The dean, also a great friend of George Corner's, took advantage of a little deansmanship. You understand that. Took advantage of a little deansmanship and said, Bill, they just complained they didn't put it in writing. And down here in the small print it says I don't have to bring it up to the executive faculty unless I have it in writing. And so nothing ever happened. But these courses were, and needless to say, the next lecture, despite the fact that we'd lost 20%, of course we only gave this course to seniors. They were the only ones that were ready. Despite the fact that 20% of the class left in protest, I had so many seniors that looked like freshmen and sophomores, it was amazing. But in any event, the course got filled and the course got given. We have a great deal of debt to pay to our friend from Philadelphia, who has done a tremendous job of spreading the word about sex education in the medical group, who has pushed it tremendously, and we're all aware. It was about this time, 59 and 60, that we began contending with sabotage. And I guess I have to talk about that, at least briefly. I described the sabotage of trying to identify the study subjects. That went on constantly. If, for instance, we would go over to the, some idea of sabotage, we'd go over to the medical school to borrow the two-channel recording equipment, all they had in the medical school, bring it over and put it outside the little quarters in order to standardize it, we'd come back and a part would be missing. We had to stand guard over the equipment. And then the personal attacks began, but the fascinating thing is the personal attacks we had expected. What we didn't expect was how they were done. They were fundamentally carried out against our children. Our children were socially ostracized. Our children were bitterly attacked as being sex mongers. I had to move my daughter from St. Louis and send her to prep school. You really have no frame of reference. Wardell would know. You really have no frame of reference of what happened. It was incredible. About this time, 1960, we tried to present our first publications on physiology to the OBGYN journals and to psychiatric journals. Psychiatry rejected the material outright as pornographic, and OBGYN banned me for life in both journals. That ban has since been rescinded voluntarily, but it'll be a long time before I put an article in either journal. Mainly the rest of my life. But this is the type of thing that happens professionally. I might tell you, and this is not a hooray for me story, but it is a true story. At the time of our first publication in 1959, I'd had 13 offers to head various medical school departments of OBGYN around the country. I never had another. It gives you some idea about the approach of OBGYN to sexual problems. Obstetrician gynecologists are a unique group of people. They fundamentally believe that every conception is immaculate. And it's only been, as a matter of fact, it's only been since 1971 or 72 that OBGYN has allowed the subject of sex to be discussed at the annual meetings. That was 10 years after we began teaching courses to medical students. Well, in 1966, we published HSR. Why did we publish the physiology text first? We could have easily published the psychotherapy text. Well, we did it deliberately. We knew that no matter what we did, we would be wrong. And we were. We thought about it for a long while. If we publish the physiology first, everybody will call us mechanics. Well, we published the physiology first, and everybody called us mechanics. If we published the psychotherapy first with no background of being known in the field, everybody would say those kooks and forget it. So we decided to take the first risk and publish the physiology first. The hate mail was unbelievable. From the time of a week after the publication of the text, for the next year and a half, we had extra secretaries, two secretaries for a year and one secretary for the next 6 months, just answering mail. We scheduled the mail in three categories: drop dead, legitimate questions, and hooray for you. Drop dead category for the first 6 months was about 90 to 95% of the mail. I'm sure that the Palmer, Kinsey Palmer group had the same experience. The hooray for you mail, that was about 1 or 2%. And legitimate questions about 5, 6, 7%. Came from all over the world. One lady from California wrote a letter to the police department demanded that we be raided because of the orgies we were conducting. Well, the letter was given to the head of the sex unit at the police department, and he and I, by this time, had been good friends. We'd been together for a year, so he called me and said, "Bill, I've got to raid you. When would it be a convenient time?" I said, "How about next Tuesday at 2 o'clock? He said, "Fine, we'll be there." So he was at 2 o'clock with two policemen. He said, "Do you want a warrant?" I said, "No, please come in." He looked all around, investigated everything. Well, I said, "Bill, I couldn't find a thing wrong." I said, "That doesn't surprise me." It's fascinating You have no frame of reference for the time. All you need to know is that it was terrible, and yet it was something that we had anticipated, and it is something that we have not only excused, but understand. The only thing we found difficulty with was the attack on the children. And we should have thought of that, and we didn't. Well, after HSR, HSI, we've talked about the background of that sort of thing. There was still more hate mail from HSI, but nothing like there was from HSR. Nothing. We began postgraduate training programs in 1971. These have consisted of training people in residence and workshops and seminars. Bob Kolodny would have the actual figure and number of people that we've seen in workshops and seminars, but I know it's 12,000, 13,000. How many of the people we've trained individually, I literally have lost track. We're proud to say that they're all around the country, and this is fine. Homosexuality, the physiology, we would approach that the same way we did the heterosexuality. Whether one agrees with the text or the procedure or not, we did it the same way. We spent from 64 to 70 doing various phases of the physiology. Not in any sense the rush or the driving demand that we did for the physiology of heterosexuality. The main reason for doing that driving demand for the physiology of heterosexual response was we were afraid we'd be stopped at any time. If we'd been stopped before we had something to present, I would have lost an MD because I've been eternally accused of being a voyeur. So we were gambling a degree, and therefore we were working our tails off to try to protect it. We began treating homosexuality fundamentally for dysfunction and disorder. I was amazed at the time that what medicine had done to impotent homosexuals or anorgasmic lesbians. They'd refused to treat them, or else attempt to treat them to try to convert them to heterosexuality, and tragic. But they were always refused treatment because they were homosexual. So we began there. We also accepted those who wished to convert or revert to heterosexuality, and in one instance, a couple who wished to convert to homosexuality. The last thing I want to talk about really is the concern for the ethics. In the mid-70s, it was patently obvious that we were growing like Topsy, and we had no ethical standards. It was also patently obvious that no individual was capable of establishing ethical standards, or had the right to establish ethical standards. So it made it incumbent upon the Institute to do the following. In 76, I think it was, we convened a conference of top flight representatives around the country of law, first place ethicists, law, religion, sociology, nursing, various parts of medicine, psychology, OBGYN, urology, general medicine, clinical psych, social psych, experimental psych, you name it, the social work, we had it. They identified a bunch of issues. The National Science Foundation and NIMH each gave us $5,000 for this. It cost about $18,000 or $19,000. And then we appointed committees to work on five major issues for the following 2 years or year and a half. And these committees came back in person and reported their findings, and the subjects were criticized, and they went back to the drawing board again. They did this twice before they finally appeared at the Congress to present these five issues that everyone agreed should be discussed at great length. For the Congress, we had exactly the same sort of representation, except it was magnified. In order to be absolutely objective about this, from the day the Congress opened until the day the Congress closed, I never opened my mouth. I felt it would be absolutely certain that because the Institute was sponsoring the Ethic Convention, that it should not be considered Masters and Johnson ethics. As a matter of fact, I disagree with some of the ethical stands that were made, but I don't disagree with the fact that they should be made. And so then there have been two publications, two books on the subject of the ethics, one in 77 and the other in 80, reporting first the Congress and the conference and then the Congress. I think these are excellent texts. There's some wonderful papers in there on ethical stand. If you haven't read them, I commend them to you. I can do that because they aren't ours. Whether one accepts the concept of ethics at all or not, whether this should be free flow, is a matter of debate. If there should be ethics, then there should be the ethics of the total educated population, not the ethics of individuals. A point of departure. Employed a lot of this ethical background that we described. Whether one should support that or not is another matter in ethics. The fact remains that there has to be a point of departure. We cannot continue to grow as a discipline unless we have some manner of ethical commitment. Some manner. And these are no sense suggested as the final word. These are suggested as a point of departure. There has to be something to agree or disagree about. We've published since 79 was really a banner year. We had the publication of Homosexuality in Perspective, and the textbook of Human Sexuality for Nurses, textbook of Sexual Medicine, but last two of which they were Bob Plotny's brainchilds. And in 82, he developed the text on human sexuality that I think is just an excellent text for general discussion. Finally, there have been 9 major books published, only one for the general public, and that was The Pleasure Bond, which was published in 1970. I happen to think it's 10 years before its time, because it fundamentally presented the concept of sex as a natural function. We have made many mistakes. A lot of the work we've done has been inadequate. But our greatest failure has been the failure to convince medicine first and the behavioral sciences second that sex is a natural function. Every one of you know it, but none of you live it, and very few of you practice it. And until we do accept the concept of sex as a natural function, this boy in utero with an erection, a baby girl that lubricates 8 or 12 hours after birth, these are things they were congenitally determined to do. They've had no chance to be taught. We will always be in difficulty in our therapy. If you try to teach a man to have an erection, you can't do that. It's like teaching him to breathe. You can remove the roadblocks and let Mother Nature take over, but you can't teach him. I've glossed over the objections, the persecutions, the family tragedies. Primarily because Vern did a very good job of that yesterday, and because I just soon not talk about it. We were entitled to all of the backlash that we got because we were moving into a sacrosanct field, and we knew it. We felt it was unfair to the children, but we should have anticipated that. I have always enjoyed the opportunity of working with a group such as this, particularly the young in the group, who won't have to face what we faced in the past. And I must tell you that we didn't begin to face what we might have faced if it weren't for men like Alfred Kinsey and Wardell Baumrind. Thank you.